Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It is the time of year for many of us to think about gift giving, and we're also anticipating getting cozy with some books as the winter bears down. It's time to find out about the best new books to give and receive this holiday season. Today, we'll talk about books for grown-ups. Tomorrow, books for kids. And of course, we know that you have some favorite books that you would love to share. We are collecting your recommendations. You can go to iowapublicradio.org/talkofiowa. There's a banner on the page that says, "What books did you love this year?" Click on that banner and you'll have a chance to tell us all about them. To tell us about their favorite new books this year, we've invited Jan Weiss-Miller and Tim Butt of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Hello, Jan.
Hello, Charity.
And Tim, hello.
Good morning.
And also with us, Terry LeBlanc of Swamp Fox Bookstore in Marion. Welcome, Terry.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here on your first appearance on this show. And in honor of that, we are going to start with fiction books today. And I'm going to put you in the hot seat right off the bat. Tell us about your first fiction pick.
My first fiction pick, it was a favorite of everybody in the shop, Amanda, Ursula, and I, and it's Finley Donovan is Killing It by El Cosimano, and it's a laugh-out-loud mystery story about a mother who is an author who mistakenly gets mistaken for a contract killer and is dragged into a life of crime with her nanny. They are like the next Ethel and Lucy of the literary world.
So it's funny, yeah. Suspenseful.
A little bit, yeah, but more on the humorous side of the mystery than it is. The dark thriller type of thing.
So. All right, so this sounds like a fun escape.
It is very much a fun escape. And if you are a fan of audiobook, the audiobook is magnificently narrated. The narrator kills the little girl's voice, Finley's daughter.
Oh, fun. All right. Finley Donovan is killing it. And Jan, why don't you go next? What's your first fiction pick?
I'm going to do Crossroads by Jonathan Franzen, which I have liked him despite the controversy. And this book is set in 1970s, right about 1970, actually, in the Chicago suburbs. And the main character is... the main group of characters is the family of a minister named Russ Hildebrandt that has a youth that's actually just recently been dethroned from heading this youth group called Crossroads, and this sort of creepy younger guy is doing it. And Russ's wife, Marion, who is a very complex character. You get a lot of backstory for Marion and his three children. Actually has four, but one of them hardly plays a role at all because he's too young. But he has a son who's 21 and still in college, but decides that he might need to drop out so that he can go to Vietnam because he's afraid. You know, there's this sort of moral thing about in the whole book that he's afraid that he's letting the poor people fight the war. Mm. And then Becky, the daughter who's the cheerleader, young, beautiful type girl who falls in love with a rock star and changes her life, and Perry, who's their very bright, very troubled 17-year-old. And as Jonathan Franzen is wont to do, each chapter sort of takes a character, and it's 600 pages, but it's very fast, and he, you know, it's serious, but it's also funny. And when I got to the end of it, I thought, wow, he has left a lot of things up in the air. And then I read, oh, it's one of a trilogy. It's the first of a trilogy.
So there is a lot more coming. And also, if this is something that you're planning on reading, it sounds like you want to do it now so you don't get behind. And then all of a sudden you have to read three 600-page novels in a row.
I can't imagine he's going to get the next one out super fast. You probably have at least 2 years, I would think, to read this.
All right. That is Crossroads by Jonathan Franzen. And of course, we've been hearing a lot about that. Have you been selling a lot of that, too?
We have, yes.
All right, Tim, you are up next.
My first choice is a novel called How to Find Your Way in the Dark
by Derek B. Miller. And this was sort of a surprise for me. I knew Derek Miller. I'd read one of his previous novels. But I picked this up not knowing anything about it and absolutely loved it. It is the coming-of-age story of Sheldon Horowitz from 1938 to just post-World War II, 1947. His mother has died, and then his father is killed in an accident. So Sheldon has to go live with his uncle, Nate, and his cousins, Mirabelle and Abe, who are much older. Sheldon is 12 at this time, and his cousins are 17 and 18. So it's a big change for him. So it's really the World War II experience at home in a domestic situation, and also a Jewish experience. It's a Jewish family, so you're looking at it from that lens. His uncle Nate has changed his name from Horowitz to Corbin because it's just easier for business reasons, and works at a Colt Armory in New Hartford, Connecticut, which is where the story is based. It is a dark comedy, I would call this, because there is tragedy in Sheldon's life, but it is very funny, just in the way that kids are so resilient. And he decides to try to take revenge on his father's, who he thinks is responsible for his father's death. So it's a long revenge tale. It's the coming of age tale. It is just the wacky family that they live in. And the brilliant part is when he and his friend Lenny go to the Catskills to work for the summer because Lenny wants to be a stand-up comedian. So I just think it's delightful and surprising and charming, and even the darkest moments are handled with fun. And in his acknowledgments at the end, the author writes, "And for the record, Santa is alive and well and loves this book and thinks it would make an excellent Christmas present." So there you have the author endorsing his own work. But it is just a delight from beginning to end.
Subtle hint.
Yes, yes, yes.
All right. How to Find Your Way in the Dark by Derek B. Miller. And Terry, that brings us back around to you.
So I want to recommend Corporate Gunslinger by Doug Engstrom. He's actually an Iowa author, and this is his debut novel. And it's set in a near future world where you can settle your disagreements with your insurance company by going head to head with a professional gunslinger. And the main character, Kira, is drawn into this life as a corporate gunslinger because she is under an immense amount of student debt. So it's a very dark, gritty tale about the desperation that debt and will drive some people to. So.
All right. Well, this sounds like perhaps driven a little bit by current events.
Yes, there is. I interviewed Doug earlier this year, and there's actually a little bit, you know, science fiction, fantasy, sometimes they seem to predict the future. And there is a scene where you find out that Kira has lost her parents due to some illness where she couldn't even hug them to say goodbye.
Oh, wow. And did he start writing that before 2020?
Yes, he did.
I don't like that kind of fortune telling. But it sounds like a good read, though. Corporate Gunslinger by Doug Engstrom. And that brings us back to you, Jan.
Well, maybe I was going to do Netanyahu's next, but I think I'll do Bewilderment, the Richard Powers book, because maybe that plays in a little bit to what we just heard about. And that it's Richard Powers, you know, was a Pulitzer Prize winner for Overstory, and this book is much shorter. It's loosely based on Flowers for Algernon. It's okay. This kind of, it does have a mild sci-fi. But the situation is that there's a man named Theo who's an astrophysicist, and he is widowed, and his son is 9 and having a lot of trouble. The wife has been dead for 2 years. She was a legal advocate for animal rights, and she was killed in a car accident because she was trying to avoid an animal on the road. And the little boy is having a lot of trouble. And so the father, for one thing, takes him on these imaginary trips to these planets, which is really amazing. I mean, you know, where they talk about life. And there is this kind of climate change, end of the world feel to the book. But also he hooks him up to, he knows a neuroscientist in the university where he teaches. And this neuroscientist is doing research on transmitting brain waves from one person to another. And so they decide that they've got, I don't know how they got them, but they have these, because the mother had been one of his subjects in his experiments, this neuroscientist. So they have these brain waves from the mother, and they transfer them to the child, which is extremely successful for a while. But anyway, I think it's a really really moving book, and obviously Richard Powers is an incredible writer.
Yeah.
It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and I recommend it very highly.
Bewilderment by Richard Powers. I did have to laugh because, you know, Overstory was one of the Talk of Iowa Book Club books, and a lot of people really loved reading it and talking about it, and a lot of people told me it was really, really long. So, all right, we've got about 2 minutes. Tim, what's your next pick?
My next pick is Under the Whispering Door by T.J. Clune, and this is the next novel after his very successful The House in the Cerulean Sea. I don't know if I can do it in 2 minutes, but it is a fantasy, sort of a Scrooge story where Walker Price, a very high-powered lawyer who is just not liked by anyone in the world, dies and is taken to a tea shop where he will then cross over. The man who runs the tea shop, Hugo, is the ferryman that will lead you to the next world. You don't have to go until you're ready. So it takes Walker a long time to adjust to being dead and then try to make amends for the life he's lived. It is that warm, fuzzy, wonderful book that just, even though it deals with death and in some cases suicide, that really is affirming about the life you lead and the life to come. It's really a beautiful, lovely book.
Well, and that's a really quick follow-up to his last book.
Yes, it really is. And it's that same tone, but it is just, especially he wrote this before the pandemic, but he says in his notes that since the pandemic came, he thinks the book is perhaps even more important, just in the way that it reassures you that a life well lived is the life to have, no matter how long or short or how much money you make or any of those things.
It's, right.
You know, only with a cup of tea and a ferryman like Hugo could you learn to see the world in the proper light.
Well, and you probably sold a whole bunch of House on the Cerulean Sea as gifts last season. So if you gave that book last year, you should just give this one this year.
It's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah.
It is exactly the same kind of tone. And you know, there was because the author is gay, there was a gay romance kind of at the heart of it as well. But it's not, you know, the main matter of the book. But really, it is just delightful watching Walker Price go from, you know, some horrible ogre of a man to sort of seeing the light.
All right. Delightful. So, yes, I spent some very pleasant hours last winter with House in the Cerulean Sea. Oh. So,
well, you would, if you did that, listeners, you will be delighted again with this new one.
Under the Whispering Door by T.J. Clune. And we are going to take a short break. We'll be back with more books to talk about in just a moment. Tim Budd and Jan Weissmiller of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City are here, along with Terry LeBlanc of Swamp Fox Bookstore in Marion. And you can also share your picks. Go to iowapublicradio.com/talkofiowa. Look for the banner that says, "What books did you love this year?" And then share your answers. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about the best new books for grown-up readers this holiday season. Tomorrow, we will talk about books for kids. And of course, we'd also like to hear your picks as well. Go to Talk of Iowa on our website, iowapublicradio.org/talkofiowa. Click on the banner that asks about your favorite books this year and tell us all about them. With us to share their favorite new books, and they are the experts in this subject, Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City and Terry LeBlanc of Swamp Fox Bookstore in Marion. We are still talking about fiction books. And Terry, it's back to you. What's your next one?
So my next one is The God of Lost Words by A.J. Hackwith, and this is actually the third and final book in her trilogy of the Hell's Library series. And this series was written specifically for people that love to read and for story lovers. In book one, you discover what stories are made of. In book two, what happens when stories stop being told or are lost. And in book three, you find it wraps up the series and you get a satisfying ending and conclusion about the sacrifice made to ensure that stories and libraries endure for all time. So it's really one of my favorite Discovery series that I found 3 years ago, and I'm really delighted with how AJ wrapped the book up.
All right, nice. The God of Lost Words, AJ Hackwith. And Jan, it's back to you.
Well, I'm going to talk about this kind of strange book. Well, it's by Joshua Cohen. It's called The Netanyahus, and it's set in the 1950s in a fictional college in upstate New York, which I have heard is based on Cornell. And it's about a visit that the father of the ex-prime minister Netanyahu pays to this college in the 1950s when he's applying for a job in the history department. And the main character is the only Jewish faculty member in the university, and he's put on the search committee and asked to take this person around, even though his field has absolutely nothing to do with the field that this guy is applying for a job for. And so it's very Philip Rothian, actually. And I had read, I had read the new Philip Roth biography, despite the problems with its author, and sort of done a little dive back into Philip Roth novels. And supposedly this novel is based on a true story that Harold Bloom told to Joshua Cohen when Harold Bloom was very old. Joshua Cohen, the author of The Netanyahus, is still in his 40s. He's quite young. He's an incredible writer. I mean, I think part of the reason that this book is so good is he's just, he's really, well, I mean, I can't say that he's better than Roth, but in that territory, he sort of does do a better job of it because he doesn't take it too far. I mean, he keeps it, well, the very end, maybe a little bit, but
spoiler alert. No.
But it's a very clear look at what it was like to be Jewish in rural America in the 1950s.
Yeah,
and
just the setup that you described, I can't tell you how many members of the academia world who are in the minority at their universities have described exactly that thing. Like, you fit this mold, you'll show this person around.
Yeah, exactly.
You're in charge.
Yeah.
So that setup, I'm sure, will feel very familiar across time.
Yes, it does.
All right. And I'm sure it raises a lot of questions, and you probably found yourself wondering, is this true?
Well, clearly it's highly fictionalized, but I'm sure that it was based on a true story.
All right. That is The Netanyahus by Joshua Cohen. And Tim, back to you.
I would like to talk about Cloud Cuckoo Land by Anthony Doerr, his follow-up to the Pulitzer Prize-winning All the Light We Cannot See. It is a complicated novel, and I spent most of the morning trying to figure out how to talk about it in just 3 minutes. It is three simultaneous stories. One is set in 15th century Constantinople, now Istanbul, when the city is under siege. The second story is set in present-day Idaho, and the third story is set far into the future in some spaceship. And what connects these three stories is a Greek story written in the first century AD called Cloud Cuckoo Land that was discovered in a tomb, and this man had put it out there, a man named Antonius Diogenes, and that book features in all three of these stories. It is a sprawling, ambitious work. His writing is beautiful. It's 625 pages. So when we were talking earlier about that, you know, a book to hunker down with in the
right
cold weather, this would be on your list. I think that the point and the theme of this novel is to he dedicates it to librarians, past and future. But the way books can touch our lives, and I was trying to think of it in modern terms, how many kids have been touched by Laura Ingalls books? How many people have been touched by Jane Austen? And just that these books have a life kind of on their own in the readers, no matter what time or place you're from. And of course, libraries feature very heavily in all three parts of this. One is a ruined library in a monastery, one is a present-day small-town Idaho library, and one is a digitalized hologram library in this spaceship. So if you're a reader, if you like books and you love it, and you love to read, you will really enjoy this book. The format is a little bit tough because you get interspersed with the Cloud Cuckoo Land from the first century AD, and then you are the three stories that go simultaneously. So you get short little chapters as these parallel stories click along. So it takes some dedication, I think, and it is not quite the page turner, although Light We Cannot See is, but it is still a beautiful, rambling story to get lost in. And I can't think of anything more perfect to read in, you know, the twilight of winter.
Yeah, you know. And I think you did a great job talking about it in 3 minutes. Okay, good, and that's thanks. Also a challenge that I know a lot of people have tried to tackle recently. I've heard a lot about this book, Cloud Cuckoo Land by Anthony Doerr. And that brings us back to you, Terry.
So I want to recommend The Echo Wife by Sarah Gailey. I listened to this book, started listening to this book on a drive earlier this year, got to where I was going, and then had to pick up the book to finish it because I had to know how it ended. It's part thriller, part mystery, and part ethical dilemma. The main character is a scientist, and she has perfected cloning. And in the future, cloning is only used for organ farming and for body doubles, for like political figures. and she finds out that her ex-husband has taken her research and created a better version of her. And one day, the clone calls Evelyn, the scientist, and says, Martine says, Evelyn, there's been a horrible accident. You need to come over to the house. Evelyn goes over to visit, even though she doesn't want to, and discovers that Martine, the clone, has murdered the husband slash ex-husband. And so the story weaves like what happens with Evelyn and Martine, what happens with Evelyn's research, and also spinning in Evelyn's backstory of how she ended up being divorced from her husband.
So, all right.
Kind of leave you on the edge of your seat.
Interesting sisterhood developing there. The Echo Wife by Sarah Gailey. And that brings us back to you, Jan.
Well, then I'll seek into Elizabeth Strout's new book, O William, which also has to do with wives. I don't know. You know, Elizabeth Strout's interesting because she's got these kind of two characters that she follows through a different series of books, like The Isle of Kittredge, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize, mm-hmm. appears in the novel she wrote a couple of years ago called Olive Again. But the O. William is based on Lucy Barton. And Lucy Barton first appeared in a book, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago called My Name is Lucy Barton. And Lucy Barton is a woman that's in her 60s who grew up in absolute abject poverty in rural Illinois in the 50s and 60s. And so you can read this book without knowing her backstory because Strout's really excellent at just doing these flashback things. But O. William is a phrase that's repeated over and over in this book because William is Lucy Barton's first husband. And the book starts with a moment when she has lost her second husband, who was the love of her life, and he has died, and William's third wife has left him. And they're searching for, they do have two grown daughters in common, and they have a very good relationship, but he wasn't emotionally present enough in their marriage for her to stay with him. And so this is sort of, the whole book is sort of tracking of what made him emotionally distant. And so you keep hearing, oh, William, because she feels so bad for him that he can't quite get there, you know. But they're also, he does one of those ancestry tests and he finds out that his mother had a daughter that she left. And so they go to find this daughter, which sort of unravels the mystery of his emotional distance, but not completely. It's a very moving book. I mean, you know, the characters are all very whole. And I mean, I guess I'm giving too much away, maybe. I really recommend it.
Doesn't it make you wonder how these characters live in Elizabeth Strout's mind? Like,
yes.
They must be constantly doing things and evolving, and she can't leave them behind.
She can't. I mean, I do like Olive Kittredge quite a lot, but I prefer Lucy Barton.
All right. O. William by Elizabeth Strout. And Tim, your turn again.
The next novel I'd like to talk about is called What Strange Paradise by Omar El Akkad. He's an American journalist, and this is his second novel. And I talked about his first novel on this program called American War, which was sort of a dystopian look at America in the future fighting over fossil fuels. What Strange Paradise is the story of Amir, a 9-year-old Syrian refugee boy. And we follow his life from Syria to a harrowing journey across the Mediterranean. And he lands on a Greek island where he is sort of befriended and adopted by Vanna, a 15-year-old girl. And it really is then the story of Vanna trying to help this boy find some refuge and solace because he's being hunted by military who, of course, comb the beach regularly. But it is very immersive, I think, because of the author's journalistic background. And you're reading this book and you are in that boat. You are on that beach. And it's the kind of book for someone who's socially conscious, who is issue driven. It really explains the refugee situation from a child's point of view, where you don't really understand anything or everything. And even as adults, how can we understand all the complexities of it? And it is somewhat allegorical because Vanna sort of represents the good part of the Western world, and Amir is sort of the poster boy for all refugees, and the general who's hunting him sort of is that whole law side. So it's sort of a fable almost, but it is very moving. And that boat ride, I don't know how the author recreated it, but it is a tense journey across the Mediterranean, and shocking in many ways. Your heart really goes out to this child. A beautiful book.
What Strange Paradise by Omar El Akkad. And let's do one more fiction pick, but let's do it quickly. Terry?
I want to recommend Sisters in Arms by Kaia Alderson. I know there are a lot of World War II historical fiction books out there, but what stands out about Kaia's book, it is about the 6888, which was a group of black women that were stationed over in Europe that helped deliver the mail to the servicemen that were serving over there for the U.S. So it kind of shows their struggle for equality and just to have a life, and also follows at least one black soldier and his goal to, you know, be recognized as a full soldier in the military during that time.
All right, Sisters in Arms by Kaia Alderson. Jan, your final fiction pick.
Well, I'm just going to put in a little plug for the Sally Rooney book, which is also very controversial. Is it good or is it not? And I fall on the side of it is, and it's called Beautiful World, Where Are You? And Sally Rooney is young. She's 32. It's her third book. She became very famous with a book called Conversations with Friends, which actually I don't recommend, when she was 25. And then Normal People, which I thought was, when I read Normal People, she wrote when she was 28, I thought it was maybe the best book about class that I'd ever read. Because it didn't make it the direct subject, but it was really good. And there's a lot of that in this book, too. And it follows Alice, who's a writer that's not comfortable with her fame, and her best friend Eileen from college. Largely, it is about their relationship and their relationships with men and their discussions about world issues.
All right. And it sounds like you could get into some lively debates after you read it as well.
Yes, you could.
Maybe even in a bookstore. All right. Beautiful World, Where Are You? By Sally Rooney. And Tim, did you want to talk about another fiction pick, or do you want to move on?
I will move on. I'm not totally certain of the author's first name, and I would hate to plug a book incorrectly.
All right, I can check for you. But let's move on to nonfiction, which I know a lot of people love and are looking for. So, Tim, why don't you start us off with your first nonfiction pick?
My first pick is The Boys, a memoir of Hollywood and family by Ron Howard and Clint Howard.
I just heard them on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
They were hilarious.
Anyway,
go on.
The book is just fascinating, and because not only does it chronicle Ron and Clint's, acting career from 1960 to 1980, Ron Howard was probably all over our TV sets. And then Clint, of course, was in Gentle Ben.
I actually did not know. I mean, of course, remember Opie, Ron Howard, and he was so many places. I didn't realize that his brother was really equally famous.
Well, at one point, they were on opposite channels at the same time. I mean, at one point, Mayberry was the number one show and Gentle Ben was the number two show in the same household. It's a real tribute to the parents, though. Rance and Jean Howard. They were Oklahoma farm kids who both were actors in school and theater. They tried to make a go of it in New York. But when they saw when live TV was kind of leaving the East Coast and going to the West Coast, they packed up Baby Ron, they moved to Burbank, and sort of the rest is history. And I think it's really a tribute to the parents because they were down to earth. They did not live beyond their means. They made sure those kids were grounded, and they went with them everywhere. Those kids were never on their own. One of the parents would always go to the set, to the studio, to auditions. They were always there. What I found particularly interesting about the book is that not only do you get a chronicle of American television through this time period, is that you also finally unlock the mystery of why child actors don't make it after they've grown up. And he talks about, I think because his parents were Midwesterners who were farmers and were grounded, part of that was their guidance, but also because the parents never let those kids know that they were the breadwinners of the family. They kept a pretty hard lock on the money, only kind of letting them have a car when they were 16 and that sort of thing. But they didn't ever let the kids know how much money they were making. And that was only released to them when they were 18. But Ron talks about when you stop being cute, if you don't have the talent behind that or some training, which the parents gave them because they were actors, kids, you know, can't pull on the tears or the smiles or the tap dance because it doesn't look good when you're 18 as it did when you were 8. And, you know, if you don't think so, just watch whatever happened to Baby Jane with Bette Davis. It's just a down-to-earth, really wonderful look at an American family and American history.
The Boys, A Memoir of Hollywood and Family by Ron Howard and his brother Clint Howard, both very famous as child actors. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's our holiday book show. We're talking about the best new books for grown-ups this hour. We will talk about kids' books tomorrow. And with me to talk about grown-up books, we have Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City and Terry LeBlanc of Swamp Fox Bookstore in Marion. And we just started off talking about nonfiction with The Boys, A Memoir of Hollywood and Family by Ron Howard and Clint Howard. And that brings us around to you, Terry, and your first nonfiction pick.
So I'm a big horse person. I actually own a horse, so I pick up a lot of books that kind of fit in that. And I read The Ride of Her Life by the true story of a woman, her horse, and their last chance journey across America by Elizabeth Letts. So if you remember, Elizabeth has written other books, including The Perfect Horse, which is about them saving the Lipizzaner stallions during the World War I. And this actually chronicles the life of Annie Wilkins in 1954, jumps on her horse and rides from Maine all the way to California, and her journey and the people she met and how she successfully crossed the country in a time when interstates were just becoming a thing. There wasn't some big map you could follow. There was no GPS. So how do you do that with just you, your dog, and your horse? It was really uplifting, and I loved every minute of it.
The dog story is almost as good as the horse story, probably. That's a long trot for anybody.
It is. And I was floored when I started reading it. She left Maine in like October or November. So she's traveling through the upper part of the United States during the, you know, start of winter.
Wow.
That was a good question.
I'm not reading a book.
Yeah. She just, but she, you know, she did it. And it's kind of, it's also a chronicle of like how cars became part of the culture of America and like where horses have gone and where they're going.
All right. The Ride of Her Life by Elizabeth Letts. And I feel like horse books, you know exactly who in your life should receive that book.
Yes.
All right. Horse people are horse people. We know them. All right. Jan, your first nonfiction pick.
Oh, I'm going to do Wildland by Evan Osnos, and it's subtitled The Making of America's Fury. So it's but Evan Osnos writes for The New Yorker. He's their foreign correspondent. He was in China actually for a long time, and he's been back. His last book, I believe, was about China, but he's been back here since 2011 maybe, and he was shocked when he came back at how changed the country was just between 2001 and 2011, I think largely because after September 11th, we became a different country. And so he decided to write this book, bookending September 11th and January 6th, the Capitol assault. But he does it by just looking at three areas in America. One is Greenwich, Connecticut, where he grew up, like, you know, 30 years ago or something, when it was still upscale, but not like it is now. I mean, now it's more wealthy than Silicon Valley because of, and less moral because of hedge fund, you know. And his first job in journalism was in West Virginia. So he looks at West Virginia and very interesting about Manchin, too. And Chicago, where his family was from, his father's family was from. And in Chicago, he looks at the history of segregation in America, but the housing projects in Chicago, what happened, you know, when they closed out. It's a very interesting look at what actually has happened with policing in Chicago. And he's a very good writer. He's you can read it kind of like we were talking before the program began with the 1619 Project. You can read it without getting emotionally distraught. You can read it and just feel like, oh, this is what happened. This is clear. And to some extent, then, it at least gives you a path forward in terms of what you'd like to be done. I mean, that you know what the solution would be, whether or not it can ever be implemented, because the problems are so much about income disparity in each of these cases.
So it helps you feel like you were connecting dots?
Yeah, very much.
All right. Wildland, The Making of America's Fury by Evan Osnos. And Tim, your next nonfiction pick.
My next pick is a book called 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet by Pamela Paul. And Ms. Paul is the editor for the New York Times Book Review. She started this book before the pandemic. And in the introduction, she's quick to say we would never have made it through the lockdown without the internet. So she is fairly balanced in her hate-love relationship with the internet. But these are just a series of quick little thumbnail sketches, essays, you know, 1 to 4 pages, 5 pages, depending on what she's dealing with. But for instance, she covers things like birthday cards, window shopping, penmanship, blind dates, social cues, maps, all these things. And some of them are dealt, you know, very witty and kind of clever and funny. And some take a more sobering look. She bemoans the loss of the kitchen phone that was the hub of the house with that long, long cord that everybody would get tangled up in.
okay, I'm not going to mourn that. Yeah,
well, there are some things she said there you're glad to see gone, other things that you might miss. What's some interesting things is at the Library of Congress, where they're inputting things into a digital library, they have young volunteers that have to be paired with older volunteers because the young volunteers cannot read cursive. Mm-hmm. So it's little things like that that she said someone 20 years old looking at this book would go, what is that anyway? So it's really for an older reader with some sense of nostalgia. And it's, you know, you can put it down, pick it up, put it down, pick it up. It's, you know, it's just very fun to read.
A conversation starter.
Exactly, exactly. And you can make your own list.
Right, lead to boring things for my children.
Well,
like,
boredom
let me tell you about a card catalog, children.
Boredom is one of the, boredom is what, card catalogs is in here. And boredom is one of the things she says we've lost. We don't know how to be bored anymore, which would lead us to more imagination and maybe some inventions. But now we just, you know, play Angry Birds.
So. Although our parents can still bore us. I'm sure that my children would argue that one. All right, 100 things we've lost to the internet. And that brings us back to you, Terry.
So to fit with that, I would recommend How to Resist Amazon and Why by Danny Kane. It's an insightful series of essays by indie bookstore owner Danny Kane about Amazon's business practices and how it affects all, not just independent bookstores, but all small independent businesses in the United States. So I learned a lot about, you know, some of the things that Amazon does and what you can do on a personal level to try to break up with Amazon, which is hard to do.
Yeah, for sure. And so this sounds like something there could be a support group for all independent bookstores.
Yes.
And, yes. All right. One of those things. We need books to be mirrors and windows. This one's a mirror.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
All right. How to Resist Amazon and Why by Danny Kane. And back to you, Jan.
Well, I'm going to talk about two books that you are very familiar with, and they actually, one of the ways to resist Amazon as a bookseller, is to have books by local people that are signed and that that the customers feel a personal connection to. And that's what these two books are. And one is The Ninth Decade, An Octogenarian's Journal by Carl Chronicle by Carl Claus. And, Carl started the University of Iowa nonfiction writing program in the 60s and has written these sort of journal books, journaling, chronicling various aspects of his life for 25 or 30 years. The first was My Vegetable Love, which is about gardening and eating and cooking, and is actually very wonderful and would be a good companion piece to the new Alice Waters book, We Are What We Eat, which I also recommend. And but this book is about aging. And it's kind of remarkable that someone that's nearly 90 can write so clearly about both the joys and the obviously huge challenges of aging. And one of my other customers that's in his age group read it and said to me that she was so moved by it because he was able to be so tender with both himself and with the other characters in the book, or the people, the people in his orbit. And I thought, actually, that's a very true aspect of reading this book, and it's I think probably speaks to how we all hope that we can age, to empathetically, to both ourselves and others, compassionately and empathetically. So I recommend it. It's got a beautiful cover that's designed by Claudia McGehee, and there are signed copies in Prairie Lights.
All right, The Ninth Decade by Carl Claus. You can also go back and listen to my interview with Carl Claus. And it really is, I think about how often we do see older characters in books, but it's always from the outside looking in, and he gives us the window from the inside. This is what I'm feeling. This is what I'm experiencing. This is what I'm thinking. And he did do a lovely job with it. And you had another Iowa City
author. Oh, I was just going to quickly say that North Liberty, Chewy Rentiera, who has also been on Charity's show, we heard it when we were young. And North Liberty was the first...
West Liberty.
West Liberty was the first town in the state of Iowa that was as diverse as...
Hispanic.
Majority. And he grew up there, and he describes that childhood also in a very, I'd say, compassionate way. And these two books have that very much in common. And he's an incredibly charismatic being and writer. And so I recommend this book very much. And just as a way to think about all these towns across the whole country, I mean, it gives you insight into all of our diverse.
On a lot of levels, I had Chewy on the book club episode about Bill Bryson's The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid, which was his memoir about growing up in the 1950s. And so Chewy and I had a lot of really interesting conversations about his memoir and sort of the parallels. And also, small town Iowa, there are some arguments to be made that those, as nostalgic as we get about the 50s and 60s and the freedoms that kids had in the 50s, 60s and 70s, in a lot of small towns, kids still have that kind of existence, or can. And there's a double edge to that as well. So yeah, it's a great book, Chewy Rentiera. We heard it when we were young. And that brings us back to you, Tim.
The next little nonfiction book I'll talk about is called The Passenger by Chaney Kwok. The Passenger has a long subtitle, How a Travel Writer Learned to Love Cruises and Other Lies from a Sinking Ship. And Chaney Kwok is a freelance travel writer based in San Francisco. He's in his 40s when he is on a cruise ship, and he feels a bit like an interloper. He's just writing an article. He's not paying for the trip. Everyone else on the trip are, retirees or elderly. And off the coast of Norway, they encounter a very bad storm, which nearly sinks the ship. So for 27 hours, the ship has no power, no movement. Everyone on the ship is recruited. The girl who was singing with the band for entertainment last night is now passing out life jackets and warm socks. Some of the people who are in desperate straits are being lifted off the boat by a helicopter. So it's a pretty traumatic experience, but he still has phone service. So he can check Twitter and Google to see what the outside world is saying about the ship that he is on, trying to – I mean, it really makes him face his own mortality. He's been with the same partner for 20 years, and he's wondering if that is worthwhile. He thinks about his parents and their emigration to the U.S. from Korea and how difficult that was. And he seems to question all these big life moments when you're, threatened with going underwater. So he writes beautifully, and it is a wonderfully sized book for anyone traveling over the holidays. It would maybe not on a cruise ship, no. But it is only, it's not even 175 pages long. And so it would be a great little travel book. It's a beautiful design, and it opens your eyes a lot to taking stock of where you are.
Which a lot of us have been doing in the last couple of years. All right. The Passenger by Chaney Kwok. We have 3 minutes left, so very quickly, Terry, your final nonfiction pick.
I read a lot of food memoirs this year. I don't know what it was. I was really attracted to them, and Dominique Crenn's book, Rebel Chef, In Search of What Matters, came out in paperback, and this is an amazing memoir about a survivor and an amazing chef in America. She was the first woman to get a 3 Michelin star restaurant, and she's actually French, so it's about her immigrant experience to America, not knowing anything about it, and just her journey to find out what she really wanted to do with her life, and how differently she runs her kitchens from the traditional way we hear about professional kitchens being run. And it's a very different approach, and I loved it because it was a woman chef, and you don't see a lot of those books on the shelf, and so I always want to lift those voices up. I want to hear more about those stories.
All right, Rebel Chef by Dominique Crenn and Jan.
I'm just going to go off the radar for a minute here and just put in a plug for poetry. I don't have one particular book, but I feel like I've probably read a poem or poetry or many poems every day of my life since I was 16. And I really believe that it's a meditative thing. It's extremely helpful, and I see that with our customers. And I gave one of our customers who said that he couldn't read poetry, I sit in the chair and read this. And he read September 1st, 1939, and he bought the whole Auden book, and he came back and talked to me about Auden. And I had a girl who, I don't think she ever read much at all, but she was heartbroken, and she wanted the book where the best book of heartbroken poetry. That was really hard. And I showed her quite a few, and she took X by James Galvin, which is not a particularly easy book, but that's the thing about poetry. You read it, and if it means something to you, if it hits you, it doesn't matter if you don't thoroughly understand it. And that's a good thing. I mean, it's not just for poetry, but being comfortable with not thoroughly understanding something, it would be very good for our politics.
Yes, and we could have a dialogue through poetry. All right, just a plug for poetry, and go ask Jan exactly what you should read. Tim, do you want to give us your final nonfiction pick? Are you going to go off the rails, Tim?
No, I'm going to stick with the program. And I always like to have one of these books that's sort of an ooh-ah Christmas book that lots of pictures and very cool to look at from anyone from 7 to 70. And there's a book by Chris Fitch called Subterranea, Journey into the Depths of the Earth's Most Extraordinary Underground Spaces. And it has maps and illustrations by Matthew Young. And I have to point out Matthew Young's work because it is brilliant. They cover classical world, the natural world, such as caves, but even look at underground subway systems. And they do on the seed vault up in the Arctic, that holding all the seeds and underground bunkers and military things. But what's so great is that they put the city or the landscape where the cave or this underground network might be, and then drawn a map over that so you can see where the network of underground passages lies underneath Paris or lies underneath New York or LA. So it's fascinating visuals, and you learn something, which is what a book is always great for, is that you get a little educational at the same time.
Subterranea, Journey into the Depths of Earth's Most Extraordinary Underground Spaces by Chris Fitch. Thank you so much, Jan Weissmiller, Tim Budd, and Terry LeBlanc, and we will be sharing
sharing these lists, of course, on our website at iowapublicradio.org and elsewhere. So check that out tomorrow. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.